for the last 40 years, including a special day for your furry family members. So stay tuned to WILL for more information, and thanks for supporting public radio.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today we start with an issue that's increasingly making headlines here and in other parts of the world. We're talking about the rights of LGBT people. The issue that's been in the headlines most has been same-sex marriage, but there's another issue that many consider even more important, and that's workplace discrimination. According to the Pew Research Center, 57% of LGBT people say equal employment rights should be a top priority, even more than gay marriage. And this issue is in the news again in the U.S. because the Christian charity World Vision announced last week that it would begin to hire married LGBT Christians, but then reversed course after 2 days after complaints from conservative Christian supporters. And many people are seeing this as another example where religious rights and other civil rights conflict. Now, one of the people tasked with reconciling those kinds of conflicts is the person we're going to meet now. Hai Feldblum is a commissioner of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. That agency is tasked with enforcing federal employment anti-discrimination law. She's the first openly gay person to hold that position, and she is with us now in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome, Commissioner. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
You know, in this country, quite frankly, we don't hear that much about people being discriminated against in the workplace because they are gay or lesbian. And I was wondering if the EEOC gets complaints in this area, and does the agency have the authority to look into those complaints?
Well, there unfortunately is still a lot of discrimination against people, either because they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender.
How do we know that?
Well, for many years, I think if they had come to the EEOC just told them that there was no jurisdiction for the EEOC to hear those claims, so we actually wouldn't know. About 2 years ago, the EEOC ruled that someone who's transgender and discriminated against on that basis is a form of sex discrimination. And then in some other opinions, we also explained how people who are discriminated against based on their sexual orientation, that can also be a claim of sex discrimination. Now, charges are coming in to our offices and they're not being turned away. So we have about 200 or so pending investigations right now that have been brought to us by LGBT people, and we are looking into those charges.
Now, as I understand it, 29 states do not have laws that explicitly protect gays and lesbians from employment discrimination. And as I understand it, there is no specific federal protection against discrimination based on sexual orientation. Do I have that right?
You have that correct.
So what is your authority in this area?
So we are addressing these charges as claims of sex discrimination. I mean, in the states that explicitly have protection for someone who has experienced discrimination based on sexual orientation, it makes sense to go with the state law. It says that explicitly. But in all those other states, while there is no federal law that says sexual orientation is prohibited or gender identity is prohibited as a basis of discrimination, there is a federal law that says employers may not take sex into account when they engage in an employment decision. Now, early on, people didn't think that sexual harassment was a form of sex discrimination. The EEOC said, no, that is a form of sex discrimination. We took in charges. We investigated. Some courts agreed with us. Some courts didn't. Ultimately, the Supreme Court agreed. So I expect the same trajectory to happen here.
But that has not yet happened. The EEOC has not yet litigated a matter based on sexual orientation that has worked its way through the courts.
That's correct. That's the process that I think we're looking towards, but has not happened yet.
Now, you're one of the authors of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA. That's a bill that would specifically protect sexual orientation in the workplace across the country. It has been brought up a number of times and has never passed. And I'm interested in your opinion about why you think that is the case.
Right.
Why hasn't it?
So, you know, it's funny. I often say it. I don't have kids, but I have laws. Instead of it's a boy, it's a girl, it's a law. The thing is, laws sometimes take longer than 9 months to get done. And they just depend on lots of other factors. So I think that there are still some small but vocal groups that it's hard to imagine that bill going through under a leadership that doesn't want to let it go through. So I think we're in this interesting situation in this country where the polls consistently show that an overwhelming majority of people support non-discrimination protection for LGBT people. But in terms of translating that into the politics of specifically the House of Representatives, that's just tough.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Hai Feldblum. She's a commissioner of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. That agency is tasked with enforcing federal laws against discrimination in the workplace. But one area of concern is religious freedom. And the issue we spoke about earlier, the Christian charity World Vision, first saying it would hire professed Christians who are in same-sex marriage. The leadership of this organization said that they had prayed over this for years and then reversed course after 2 days, saying that it would revert to its existing policy to not hire persons who are out LGBT people, because they said that they felt that they had to uphold their religious doctrine. Now, that is a concern for many people. I understand it's a very big topic. There's a lot of law on it. But can you just briefly describe how you think a free society is going to reconcile something like that?
You know, it's a big topic, but I think it's actually pretty simple, in a sense, for people to understand what we have already decided as a country. And let me say, I grew up as a very Orthodox Jewish person. So I am not a practicing Orthodox Jew now, but I have incredible sympathy and understanding for the feeling you have when, as a religious belief, you feel you have to act in a certain way. We wrestled with that. We, the country, Congress, when it passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it said a religious organization can discriminate on the basis of religion. A Christian organization, if it is a religious organization, can say, I'm hiring only Christians. A Jewish organization can say, I'm hiring only Jews. And in 1987, 88, I was clerking for Justice Harry Blackmun, and the Supreme Court got the case of Amos versus the Mormon Church. Amos was a building engineer. The Mormon Church owned this big gym in Salt Lake City that he worked in, and they fired him because he wasn't a quote-unquote good Mormon. He wasn't tithing, etc. The Supreme Court upheld the right of the Mormon Church to do that because the Mormon Church is a religious organization. At the same time, the courts got claims from individual Christians saying, it's against my religion for blacks and whites to intermingle, you know, and I don't want them in my barbecue shop. And the courts were consistent with saying, sorry, you know, you're in commerce. This is the law. That's what you have to comply with. So I think we as a country have made the right distinction between actual religious organizations, and we've distinguished that from individual religious people. Because otherwise it's a free-for-all in terms of someone saying, oh, that's my religious belief.
Can I ask you about the question, and I'm going to ask this question knowing that it may offend you, the question around objectivity in this area. There are some who would wonder how, as a person who has a long record of advocacy in the area of LGBT rights and other areas, by the way, and disability rights mm-hmm. as well, when you're in a position like this as a kind of a policymaking body, as a decider, can people call upon your objectivity, recognizing, as you would imagine that I would, that everyone is not asked this question, but I would ask if you would indulge me in answering it.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, you would want someone who's an African-American and someone who's a white person to be able to look at the law of Title VII and apply it as it should be applied. You would want someone who's a Christian and someone who's a Jew to be able to look at issues of religious freedom and apply the law. You would want someone who's gay and someone who's straight to be able to look at the issue and apply it as the law requires. I mean, I don't think you can say we'll never have a black person judge decide a civil rights case or a white person. I mean, because you could say, well, we'll never let heterosexual people decide these questions because they might not be objective. So, I mean, obviously, you have to trust in your judges and in your agency officials that when they took that oath, when I took that oath to uphold the Constitution, what that meant was I was going to apply the words of the law to the best of my understanding of how they should be applied and not be in the role that I was for 20 years before I came on the commission. Before that, I was an advocate. Advocate for Catholic Charities USA, advocate for disability groups, advocates for gay groups. That was very clear where my allegiance was. It was to my client. Now, my allegiance is to the law.
Before we let you go, speaking of another law, you did have a lead role in writing the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was signed in 1990, widely credited with opening doors for people with disabilities by providing equal access to accommodations and other opportunities. I'm curious about your reflections 25 years later.
You know, I told you, it's instead of kids, I have laws, right? Kids go off to school. They come back. They've got purple hair and nose rings. You're like, who are you? Laws go off to court. They meet judges. And suddenly the judges are interpreting the words in a way that Congress did not intend. And so I think it was very important that in 2008, Congress passed the ADA Amendments Act of 2008 that restored a broad definition of disability. I guess part of what I would hope is that the disability community learns from the LGBT community about the importance of coming out. I mean, I, on my Twitter feed, at Chai Feldblum, for all you Twitter fiends out there, I say that I have a hidden disability of anxiety disorder because I want to destigmatize mental illness. So I'm really hoping that in the next few years that more people will come out as people with disabilities, and maybe that'll start shaping people's societal expectations.
What do you hope to accomplish in your term as EEOC commissioner? How will you know whether you have succeeded according to your own standard?
I'm sorry I didn't wear my – I have a hat. I wrote on my hat, four-year strategic plan, because my term is up in 2018. But mostly, I would hope that generally the agency is working well with businesses, so we are working in partnership to stop unlawful employment discrimination, which means giving employers the chance to fix things right when we find out about them, and making it clear to employers that we will sue them if we need to, because that's the best way to make sure someone wants to fix things early. I would say also I'm obviously interested in areas of disability, LGBT coverage, gender equity, and religious freedom. I mean, those are sort of the issues that I have focused on in my life.
Chai Feldblum is a commissioner of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC. She was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Commissioner Feldblum, I hope you'll come back and see us. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a delight.
Just ahead, a graduate degree can come with a steep price tag. Still, for many, it's worth it.
I have a motivation that's beyond, you know, dollars and cents.
The latest in our series on paying for college, we'll talk about dealing with grad school debt. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Coming to WILL-TV, from the East Room of the White House, the President and Mrs. Obama welcome music legends and contemporary major female artists to celebrate the great foremothers of American music, with songs expressing the struggles and achievements of women. Performers include Aretha Franklin, Patti LaBelle, Janelle Monáe, Jill Scott, Melissa Etheridge, and Ariana Grande. Watch In Performance at the White House, Women of Soul, Monday night at 8 on WILL-TV.
WILL programming is made possible by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming violinist and violist Pinchas Zukerman and pianist Yefim Bronfman as they bring you a breathtaking performance of Schubert, Beethoven, and Brahms on Thursday, April 3rd at 7:30 p.m. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's spring, a time of new beginnings, but for many students, time for big decisions about college admissions and aid. So this season, we're joining our colleagues at Morning Edition to bring you stories about paying for college. We'd like to try to help you navigate that higher education money maze. Today, though, we want to focus on financing graduate school. And if you gasp at the amount of money some students owe after 4 or 5 or even 6 years of college, imagine what that bill looks like for people who spend another 2 or more years in school. Abigail Williams experienced that sticker shock. She is pursuing her PhD, but she's now more than $90,000 in debt. Her story was recently featured in the Chronicle of Higher Education, and she's with us now. Welcome, Abigail Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Deborah Stewart. She's president of the Council of Graduate Schools. That's a nonprofit organization devoted to graduate education and research. She's also featured in the article, and she's also with us here in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So, Abigail, let me start with you, and congratulations, by the way, on everything.
Oh, thank you.
So what are you studying, and why did you want to go to graduate school to begin with? Is this something that you have to do for the field that you want to go into?
Well, yes. I am currently a third-year student in the Joint Social Work and Psychology program. And, you know, like many people that are drawn to the social sciences, I have a desire to help people, you know? So I went into undergrad, became a psychology major, and basically what you find out in undergrad is that in order to get a job as a psych major, you got to go to graduate school, you know? So I began my studies, and I just had no idea that the decisions that I made at 22 or 23 would have an impact on me for the rest of my life.
When did you start to think, holy smokes, I have a lot of debt? Was there a particular moment?
Well, actually what happened was I graduated with my terminal master's degree in psychology. And when you graduate, you know, they send you all these things as if you're going to actually graduate. So exit counseling. And, you know, I went through this exit counseling as if I was going to graduate. And, you know, they said, oh, you have X amount of dollars. But then it was something at the end where it was like, when you graduate, you'll pay $900 a month out of your income once you graduate. So that's before a mortgage or any kind of rent, any kind of utilities or anything like that. And that was like a major wake-up call to me because I recently got engaged and we're thinking about buying a house. And it's just like, how can I afford a mortgage when I have $900 in, you know, student loan repayments?
Deborah Stewart, let me turn to you. According to the National Science Foundation, the amount of debt graduate students have taken on has grown by nearly 70% since 2002. Can you help us understand what's behind that increase?
Graduate debt is on the rise, to be sure, but there are a huge number of factors that explain that. First, state support for public universities has been on the decline for 20 years, and that decline really heightened during the recession. Second, third-party payers, employers who typically in the past have paid for students to go to graduate school, are now less able to do so. The third thing that's made a huge difference is undergraduate debt has increased so dramatically. Undergraduate debt has increased at a higher rate than graduate debt, so that when you get to graduate school and you borrow more, that compounds the problem.
So, Abigail, you were also telling us that you're a first-generation college graduate, undergraduate college graduate.
Yes.
A lot of people in your family really encouraged you to go to school because this was something that they had not been able to do. But presumably, they really didn't know much about the financing of it. The institutions that you attended initially, did they talk about that kind of the money, the bottom line part of it? Do you feel that they were really upfront with you about how much this would all cost?
Well, you know, you mentioned a great point about being a first-generation college student, because oftentimes, you know, you're told, go to college. You know, that's how we do it. That's how you make something of yourself. But then you don't have the educational support as well as the financial support in terms of making informed financial decisions. I don't know. I received tens of thousands of dollars in scholarships along the way. I started receiving scholarships when I was a junior in high school. However, because the increase in tuition prices, that's what's really, even with all of my scholarships, I still had to take on debt in order to pay for incidentals without having that family support to, you know, call up and say, hey, mom and dad, you know, I need my X, Y, and Z paid in. Without having that kind of support, the only way to get it, you know, is to, you know, take out loans. This is on top of jobs that I've had. I've had at least two jobs throughout all of my education. So,
Deborah Stewart, what about that? Is this the kind of conversation you're hearing with some of your member institutions?
Absolutely. Abigail is right. There is compelling proof that a graduate degree advances careers. But the fact of the matter is, people simply need to have the information to be well-informed consumers. Right now, we're working with 15 institutions around the country to develop best practices in terms of informing students like Abigail.
If you're just joining us, we're having the latest installment of our series on paying for college. Today, though, we're talking about graduate school, and we're speaking with Deborah Stewart of the Council of Graduate Schools and Abigail Williams. She's a PhD student at the University of Michigan. So, Abigail, you know, you are in a helping field. I mean, social work is not a field that is known to be terribly lucrative. And
yes.
I just have to ask, if you think somebody had been really tough with you about how much this was likely to cost and how much you're likely to make, even though you've gotten a lot of support, do you think you'd still have done it?
I do. And the reason that I do is because I have a motivation that's beyond, you know, dollars and cents. I have a motivation to help, you know, to give of my time, my energy, and my effort. You know, it's just, it's really a shame when you're told you want to help, you go get the training, but then that training, in a way, hinders you from having progress in your own life.
So, Deborah, tell me more about some of the conversations that member institutions are having around this whole question.
There are huge conversations going on right now. The first thing to remember is that while tuition, graduate tuition has gone up, it has not gone up as quickly as undergraduate tuition. So the graduate students face a compounded problem, undergraduate debt and graduate debt. Graduate institutions around the country are seeing this and are actively engaged in financial management education of the kind that we talked about before. National institutions like the Council of Graduate Schools are launching major programs, tools that students can use to be better informed. Remember that our institutions, our universities, through all of this, have provided 59% of all of the grant money. Grant money is money that students don't work for, nor do they have to pay back. Institutions themselves have provided 59% of all grant money that's gone to graduate students. They have a commitment, but everybody needs to be a partner in this. The institutions, the students, the federal government, the state governments. Graduate education is a clear national need. There is undeniable payoff in economic growth and job creation, innovation, in meeting critical social needs like Abigail is directed toward.
When you hear a story, though, like Abigail's, can I ask you for your personal opinion, like how it makes you feel? I mean, here's a young woman who's went to school, persevered after her mother died, and were raised by an aunt who pushed her to do what everybody says that she should do, and now she's $90,000 in debt. She hasn't yet finished her degree. She wants to start her new life as an adult. And when you hear a story like that, which is not an uncommon one, do you mind if I ask how it makes you feel?
Well, the first thing I feel is huge admiration for Abigail's perseverance. This is a young woman who is sticking to it, who's putting the work in, who's making the effort, and who will figure out a way to pay off this debt. That said, this is not just Abigail's problem. This is all of our problems because we need the Abigails of the world. The country needs people to make this kind of investment if we're going to succeed.
Abigail, finally, do you mind telling us about your plans? I understand that you made a decision to swear off new loans. How are you paying
yes.
for school now? And how far are you from your doctorate?
Well, I'm in my third year, so I'm about halfway through the program. And as I've mentioned before, I've gotten tremendous support from the University of Michigan. Financial, social, academic, professional, just wonderful support here. And I'm nearing the end of my time here, and I want to go on, and I do want to make that difference that we talk about making. And, you know, hopefully there'll be more support out there as I continue on.
Well, congratulations on your engagement and
thank you.
Continuing your education. Keep us posted.
Thank you.
We'd like to hear from you. Deborah, final thought from you about what are some of the avenues that your member institutions are pursuing in order to try to address this?
Well, part of it is things that our institutions can do, but I think we have to recognize that the country as a whole has to confront the problem of graduate student debt. The federal government needs to recognize that graduate education is one of the smartest investments the country can make. We need to modify graduate student loan policies so that they don't actively discriminate, as they do now, against graduate students.
How do they discriminate?
Well, for example, 2 years ago, the in-school subsidy, which historically has been available to both undergraduate and graduate students, was removed from graduate students. So now graduate students have to begin to pay back the interest on their debt while in graduate school. Now, this is an example of a federal loan policy that makes life more difficult for Abigail and for all of her colleagues. We must sustain and expand graduate fellowships and traineeships, especially in critical areas of national need, and especially for those very talented students who are able to pursue doctoral degrees like Abigail. And finally, we must restore public funding for our large public universities, because historically, they have provided a huge percentage of the graduate education given in America, and they are now hugely financially strapped.
Do you see any evidence that these recommendations are being considered? Because I have not heard any discussion of this. We've heard a number of people complaining at the undergraduate level about loan policies and underwriting standards and things like that and how it has affected particularly traditionally underserved groups, but I've not really heard any conversation about the graduate level.
The conversation about graduate student debt is just beginning. For many years, we've broadly recognized that investment of graduate education is in graduate education, from the federal government especially, has been a good thing. What we're just coming to see is the failure to sustain those investments is now causing this escalation in debt at the graduate and undergraduate level, and that has to be addressed if we're going to succeed as a country and if individuals are going to succeed as individuals.
Deborah Stewart is president of the Council of Graduate Schools. She joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Abigail Williams is a graduate student at the University of Michigan. She joined us from the campus in Ann Arbor. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just a reminder, you can weigh in with your own story or question on Twitter at #PayingForCollege. We'd like to hear from you. Now we'd like to take a moment to remember a pioneer in the world of music. You may not know Frankie Knuckles by name, but if you like to dance or if you've been to a dance club in the last couple of decades or so, then you know his sound. To his fans, he was known simply as the godfather of house music. He was born Francis Nichols in the Bronx, and he began visiting clubs in New York as a teenager. When he moved to Chicago, he began his career as a DJ and producer. The style of music he helped create and promote in the 1970s and 80s still has influence to this day. Here's a clip from his song, Your Love, which was a collaboration with the singer Jamie Principle. We wanted to tell you more about Frankie Knuckles and why he has such a big footprint in the world of music. So we've called upon Greg Kot. He is the Chicago Tribune's music critic and co-host of the public radio show Sound Opinions. Greg, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So for people who've never heard the term, what is house music? I mean, it sounds like something you play in your house.
Well, it was loosely named after the Warehouse, which was the club in Chicago where Frankie Knuckles got his start. And basically a form of dance music, disco, an offshoot of disco, and incorporating soul, R&B, gospel, even British new wave and synth pop, kind of blending all these styles together, created a sort of a foundation for what became the biggest dance music in the world. It influenced European rave culture in the late 80s, and now what we call EDM, electronic dance music. You can trace its roots back to what Frankie Knuckles was doing at the Warehouse in Chicago in 1977, 78, 79.
Why do we say that Frankie Knuckles was the godfather of house music? When we say that, what are we talking about? What did he actually do? Because it wasn't like he played the instruments, right? Or he didn't compose the music. What did he actually do?
You know, he did do some extensive mixing and producing. The track you just played by Jamie Principle was produced by Knuckles, so he was sort of a behind-the-scenes figure, but it was as a DJ that he earned his reputation as the godfather. The way he would play deeper cuts, you know, he wasn't playing like, say, Donna Summer and Bee Gees records at the height of disco. He was going much deeper than that, going for some really deep cuts from the Philly Soul catalog or gospel music or blending in Martin Luther King's speeches. He was making people hear the music in a new way. It's hard to quantify taste making and the whole notion of being sort of a father figure to a bunch of young DJs in Chicago. I mean, all of them went to see Frankie Spin, Silk Hurley and Farley Funk and Marshall Jefferson. All these music makers were inspired by seeing Frankie Knuckles. And, you know, he became a key figure in inspiring an entire scene. So from that little club on the south side of Chicago, that scene really mushroomed out in Chicago and then eventually became huge in the world. A decade later, Frankie Knuckles was a superstar in England.
Well, he talked about that. In an interview, I don't know if it was with you, or he talked about the fact that he would get off the plane and, you know, in England or elsewhere in Europe, and there would be huge crowds to greet him, and then he could walk around his own hometown, and, you know, apparently people would barely know him. It's kind of a strange thing. One other thing I wanted to quote from your piece. You wrote that he championed house music that wasn't just about rhythm, but that embraced humanism and dignified struggle. It was in keeping with his belief that the dance floor was a safe haven for the gay, African-American, and Hispanic communities that first embraced him. Could you just tell us, we only have about a minute left, can you tell us just a little bit more about what drove him, what made him tick?
I think he was an African American gay man, and I think that this music was kind of for him a sanctuary. The dance floor was a place where we could all be ourselves. You know, he embraced the misfits, the outsiders in society, and created a safe haven for them on the dance floor. And you know, that was a difficult thing to do in the late 70s. That was not something that everybody did. He will always be remembered and revered for that alone, and to take that and turn it into a mainstream thing. Truly a great accomplishment.
Greg Cott is the Chicago Tribune's music critic and co-host of the public radio show Sound Opinions. He was kind enough to join us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Greg, thanks so much for joining us to tell us about this behind-the-scenes but very important figure. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And as we go out today, we're going to go out on Frankie Knuckles' remix of the Jackson 5's Forever Came Today. Coming up, Kanye West has something to say about just about everything, from music to politics to leather jogging pants. But his favorite subject, besides himself, may be the woman he loves.
There's no way that Kim Kardashian shouldn't be on the cover of Vogue. She's like the most intriguing woman right now.
Well, Kim K and Kanye are on Vogue's cover right now, but many fashionistas say they shouldn't have made the cut. The Beauty Shop ladies weigh in on that and other news of the week. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves are going after tax refunds by filing fake returns. More at LifeLock.com, code NPR. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at Langloth.org. From the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. And from Joyce V. Hale, supporting NPR's internship program, Building a Future, One Opportunity at a Time. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how the NSA implanted malware on the servers of a Chinese telecom giant. We talk with David Sanger of the New York Times about the escalating cyber cold war between the U.S. and China. Much of his reporting on that story comes from documents leaked by Edward Snowden. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
I'm Ira Glass, the host of This American Life.
Getting stabbed wasn't even among the worst experiences of my life.
So we got this chicken and this rooster, and we're walking down Grand Street, and we feel like $1 million.
I thought, why aren't more people giving away everything that they own and walking across the country?
The poisoning myself, it's not that bad. The worst part is I get really tired.
Stories you cannot hear anywhere else. This American Life.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store and Cafe. Strawberry Fields offers a wide selection of natural vitamins and body care products for all ages, and healthy back-to-school lunch and snack options. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time to head into the beauty shop. That's what we call our conversations with our panels of women commentators and journalists. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Joan Walsh. She's editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. Veronica Miller writes about fashion and pop culture for ExoJane and TheGrio.com. Kelly Goff is a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. And Mickey Kendall is a writer and media critic with HoodFeminism.com. Welcome back, ladies, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we're not going to pretend that this is the most important news story in the world, but it is one of the most talked about. Reality show star Kim Kardashian and rapper Kanye West grace some might say disgrace, the cover of this month's Vogue magazine. It is an honor that Kanye had been lobbying for months. Here he is last fall talking with Ryan Seacrest.
There's no way that Kim Kardashian shouldn't be on the cover of Vogue. She's like the most intriguing woman. Right now, Barbara Walters is calling every day, please, let me put you on the most interesting. Of course we're the most interesting. And collectively, we're the most influential because it's true, especially with clothing. Nobody's looking at what Obama is wearing.
Well, there you have it. The manifesto, the Kimye manifesto. And, well, the president has taken some heat for those mom jeans. But the outcry is what strikes me from some Vogue lovers to this cover shot. And in fact, there was one star tweeted, you know, I'm canceling my subscription. Who's with me? So, Veronica, okay, let's start with you because you're in fashion. Why do you think this has struck such a nerve? I mean, Kim Kardashian's been on the cover of InStyle, Cosmo, People.
Well, I think because Kim Kardashian is incredibly polarizing as a celebrity, right? Because the argument that many people make when, you know, I'm Kim neutral, so I have no dog in this fight. But the argument that a lot of people make is that she hasn't actually done anything to obtain her celebrity. So I think the argument is, I mean, the discussion over this cover is fascinating that it has become such an outrage. But the thing about it is that Anna Wintour is no slouch. She knows that she's a highly polarizing figure, but she said something, and I'm paraphrasing, she said that her job of editing Vogue allows her to capture what's happening in culture at the moment. And I think putting Kanye and Kim on that cover is actually really accurate representation of where our culture is at the moment.
Kelly, what do you think? I take it you are not a fan.
Well, apparently I'm not, and a lot of other people, because boy, when Sarah Michelle Gellar tweeted that she was canceling her subscription, not only did she get thousands of favorites and retweets, but the Vogue website as well as the Vogue Facebook page was inundated by hundreds, which may not be up to thousands of people co-signing that perspective. I mean, here's what's interesting is that the first issue of Vogue back in 1892, the first person to appear on the cover was a debutante. So it was basically someone who was jobless and hadn't done very much, but looked well. And that's essentially who Kim Kardashian is. But you're right. It was much more controversial than putting Lena Dunham on the cover, even though Kim is someone who actually embraces fashion more. Kanye is certainly more equated with high fashion than Lena Dunham. But I think there's been a shift where when you put someone like Hillary Clinton on the cover a little more than 10 years ago, you put people like Oprah Winfrey on the cover. We've now seen Vogue emerge into a brand where you expect the women on the cover to be women of substance who've actually done something, as well as being known for their fashion. And Kim Kardashian doesn't meet that metric. And that's why, you know, in the piece for the Daily Beast where I was interviewing brand experts, a lot of people felt strongly this was a misstep for the Vogue brand, regardless of how you feel about Kim Kardashian.
Well, how do you feel about it? Well, I'm quoting from your piece that says, I don't buy tabloids. You were quoting one of the commenters on the site. I don't buy tabloids for a reason, because I don't look up to or find inspiration in people with no talent and even less morals. Wow. R.I.P. Vogue. The last bastion of style has fallen today. All right. So Kelly, where are you in this?
Well,
I certainly am
not seeking fashion advice or any other kind of advice from Kim Kardashian. So it didn't fit with the Vogue brand. So that, for me, is the problem, is that if she appeared on the cover of People, like we said before, it would not have been as problematic for me as someone who's not a huge Kim fan. But for the Vogue brand, when I think Vogue, I don't think Kim Kardashian. And I think that's the problem for a lot of us.
Well, you know, I have to remind people that I recall when Hillary Clinton was on the cover of Vogue, and she got a lot of I don't remember how much, but she got some very pointed, Vogue got some very pointed negative criticism about that in the letter segment from people saying she didn't belong in it because they didn't think she was fashionable enough. So there's that piece. Well, I don't know. Joan Walsh, where are you on this?
You know, I really don't get the outcry. She was not given the Nobel Peace Prize. She was not named, you know, the new editor of The New Yorker. She was put on a fashion magazine. She has a certain amount of style. You know, Vogue is all about spectacle, and Kim and Kanye are spectacle defined. And I think listening to Kanye's boast and challenge, it's like, you know, I kind of laugh at Anna Wintour just taking him seriously. Okay, here you go. And we're all talking about it, guys. And this is what sells magazines. And like it or not, you know, she did something kind of smart and edgy and twisty. And, you know, I can't remember the last time I talked about a Vogue cover except for that awful LeBron James cover that's another segment, right?
Well, how about that? You know, and I think we had that segment. One of the points she made in this interview with Seth Meyers was she pointed out that they are the first interracial couple on the cover of this magazine. He's the first rapper. And she's the first reality show star. So those are interesting points. Mickey, what do you think about this?
I'm going to be the person who, shockingly, I just don't care about Vogue.
Okay.
You're allowed
not to care. You are totally allowed
pages,
not to care.
It's 800 pages of ads, 100 pages of substance, maybe. Whoever is on the cover, it's no different than being, to me, on the cover of Cosmo or Glamour or any of the dozens of other magazines she's been on the cover of. And frankly, I agree. It sells magazines, and everyone who loves Vogue should remember that Vogue needs to make sales.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that. Thank you. Goodbye now, as I crawl under my desk in shame.
So, Michelle, can I jump in and add
sure.
one thing?
Sure.
The most striking photo in that spread, though, I think, and this is about the part of Caption the Culture, is there's a photo in there where Kim is holding their baby, North, and she's holding the baby and taking a selfie. And while she's taking a selfie, Kanye is taking a picture on his iPad. So you have all these people taking pictures of each other in the photo, and no one's paying attention to the baby. But I think it's a really accurate description or capturing this moment where we are, you know, in this culture where we're so engaged in capturing the moment with selfies and Instagram and everything without actually being engaged in the moment. And I think Kim and Kanye are kind of the epitome of that. So I think that was successful in kind of defining what our culture is right now at this moment in time.
This is interesting because I was thinking about that because I've got like millions of pictures of my kids when they were babies, but I'm not in any of them because I'm taking mm-hmm. them. And obviously there's a technology issue there because the technology that made it so easy to take pictures of yourself did not exist, you know, then in ancient history. But it's just funny that I think you make an interesting point about that. But I don't know. We can't speculate. I just think it's hilarious. That's all I can say.
Annie Leibovitz.
The baby
like,
is
somebody,
so cute.
Please pay attention to me.
The baby is adorable. If you're just joining us.
The baby was just posing. She just knows it's time to pose.
She knows.
She's got to.
We are having our Beauty Shop Roundtable with Mickey Kendall of HoodFeminism.com, Joan Walsh of Salon.com, Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast, and Veronica Miller of The Griot and XO Jane. So let's talk about another woman who's been on the cover of Vogue multiple times, Michelle Obama. The First Lady recently returned from her trip to China, where she met with the Chinese First Lady. She promoted cultural educational exchange. She fed some pandas. And she also spoke with Chinese and American students about the importance of free speech. I just want to play a short clip in case you missed it.
Time and again, we have seen that countries are stronger and more prosperous when the voices of and opinions of all their citizens can be heard. We respect the uniqueness of other cultures and societies, but when it comes to expressing yourself freely, we believe those universal rights, they are universal rights.
So John, I'm going to you first on this because critics say this is another example of where Michelle Obama could have done more. She could have said more in China about human rights and that, for example, she was criticized for not meeting Liu Xiao, who's the wife of jailed Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo, and she's under house arrest. But the Chinese authorities say she can have visitors, and some people say this is exactly the kind of thing she should be doing. She should have paid a call upon this lady and tested that theory. And so Joan, I'll start with you and then ask for other opinions about this. Do you think this is true, that the First Lady could be doing more with her job?
No. I mean, specifically in the realm of China, having listened to her speech, knowing that she talked about freedom of expression as a universal value, knowing that she also, in that speech, and I believe in another speech, talked about the example of the civil rights movement and the importance of civil rights for minorities and full inclusion for all people in a place like China, was incredibly bold of her. I think just the symbolic statement of the president ascending to a country that's not so wonderful on women's rights, his wife, his two daughters, and his mother-in-law as his emissaries was a powerful statement in itself. And, you know, the woman can't do anything right for some folks on the right, but I thought it was a powerful moment of diplomacy, and I was happy to see it.
Well, Kelly, to your point, I mean, what do you think? I mean, Joan, I would simply say that it's not just people on the right. There's people on the left who feel that it seems to me that many of the complaints about what she does with her position, with her platform, really come from people on the left. I mean, who feel that she should be doing more to flesh out a woman of such accomplishment. They feel should sort of be cutting a bigger swath. Kelly, where are you on this?
Well, yeah, because I was about to say I want Joan to actually put that in writing that I'm agreeing with someone on the right, so that people can stop saying I'm biased. The occasional times I go on Fox, that you know, you wacky liberal biased crazy person or whatever it is that they say, and I go okay, but no, you know, look. we've had this conversation on your show before. I'm sure we're going to keep having it until as long as Michelle Obama is our fabulous first lady. But, you know, for me, Michelle, I'd summarize my feelings this way. My two favorite first ladies in history are Jackie Kennedy and Eleanor Roosevelt, two very, very incredibly different women. And so my only criticism, and I say it as a form of constructive criticism and tough love, if you will, with Michelle Obama, is I feel like we've gotten a lot of the Jackie Kennedy part right. I'd like to see a little bit more of the Eleanor Roosevelt. And I know that there are people, you know, who've occasionally pushed back and say, well, how do you know that that's who she wants to be? And my response is anyone who's read her thesis from Princeton knows that this is a woman who cares deeply about issues like social justice and civil rights and has extremely strong opinions on them, which I think is awesome and fabulous. I just wish we could hear more of them and see more of that. And, you know, I'm someone who completely got when, you know, the president was facing re-election that there were positions on race and gender and reproductive rights that they kind of held a little close to their vest, right? But he's in the second term, and as much as I love seeing the Jackie Kennedy cultural ambassadorship that she brought to China, I really would love to see and hear a little bit more. That doesn't mean she has to, you know, lead a protest in the street, Michelle, but, you know, I would love to see her be a little bit more of the first lady we know she has inside, because she was that woman before she became first lady back at Princeton.
Mickey, where are you on this?
I'm going to say that at some point we have to pick a lane in terms of expectations, because when Hillary Clinton spoke in China about human rights abuses, she was blasted for it. She was overstepping the boundaries of a first lady. When Michelle Obama has brought up topics of race or class or anything else, she's blasted for it. She's literally in a no-win position. No matter what she says, someone's going to complain. I personally thought the speeches were excellent and were a nice diplomatic, I know this is a concept that has left a lot of American discourse, diplomatic step forward. Because sometimes, shockingly, especially if we are stepping away from the idea that we're the police force of the world, we have to negotiate, which means small steps, not major steps, immediately. And that is where I felt like this was coming from, that place of, let's have this conversation, let's not revisit Tiananmen, let's try to work this out slowly in the same way that we eased our way through other conflicts in other places. We're not going to see a military solution to what goes on inside Chinese borders. That's not ever going to be feasible. So we're going to have to make a diplomatic solution. And like it or not, the U.S.'s own track record for human rights abuses is not clean.
Hmm. Veronica,
we're
going to
have to work from that place.
Sorry, Mickey, excuse me. Veronica, what do you think about this?
Well, I have to agree with Joan and Mickey in that, you know, Michelle Obama's in a no-win situation. You know, when she tried to take on something as, you know, kind of as, you know, non-controversial as saying we should get kids to eat better and move around, she got blasted for that, you know, and she wore sneakers to a garden. Everything she does, if she sneezes, you know, in the wrong direction, somebody is going to have something to say about that. So, you know, to Kelly's point that, you know, wishing she'd be somewhere between Jacqueline Kennedy and Eleanor Roosevelt, I'm kind of interested in just us allowing her to be Michelle Obama and embodying that first lady position in the way that she feels is necessary to embody it. Because no matter what she does, she's not going to win. Somebody's going to have something to say. And I've learned in being in those positions in my little world, it's just easier to do what you're going to do.
Michelle, can I just say one last thing, though?
Kelly, excuse me. I'm going to move on because I have one more topic that I want to get to.
Sure.
And this is something that we'd often talk about hair. I mean, hair is a thing, you know, and sometimes people say, why are you spending so much time on hair? But this is another example of hair isn't just hair. And since we have somebody in the shop with specific expertise on this, I wanted to raise it. There's a new U.S. Army policy that has their grooming regulations that prohibit certain hairstyles. They specifically prohibit certain hairstyles like twists, certain types of braids, dreadlocks, and large afros. And critics of this policy, and there have already been people who, the 6,000 people have already signed a petition protesting this, say that this is biased against African Americans, particularly African American women, who are, by the way, overrepresented in the Army specifically. And so, Mickey, since you were in the military, I just wanted to get your take on this as briefly as you can. You have specific knowledge about it.
Okay, so let me preface this by saying that I had both cornrows and straight hair while I was in the military. And one of the facets of this, it is gender, I would say it is gender bias, but it's gender bias based on equipment. Because you have to wear a cover. You have to be able to wear Kevlar, which is a helmet. You have to be able to wear the hood of an NBC suit, which is a nuclear biological chemical suit. Big hair won't fit under certain things. It just won't. The same is true in terms of hair texture for white women with long hair. The most of this equipment is designed for a male head with a short crop haircut. High and tight, right? So most women struggle to contain their hair. I know I did. I have a big head and a lot of hair. I just do. I struggle to contain my hair through basic and beyond. And some of the styles that they are referencing are bulky and will not fit under the inside the uniform properly. Mm. You will not have a consistent fit with your gas mask. Your Kevlar will not fit correctly.
So is there
that
a way to work
this out?
Does not
mean I agree with all of that.
Yeah, is there a way to work this out in a way that satisfies people and doesn't feel as if they're specifically targeting a group of people who actually happen to be among the most supportive of their
yes.
mission and the most present, right, as the largest minority in the service, as women?
Yes. I would actually say that one of the things would be that we need to start getting equipment. You know, we're still buying equipment that's theoretically suited for a male frame of a certain height and a certain weight. But obviously that is not what our military looks like. It has not looked like that for 30 plus years. So we're going to need to make some changes in terms of equipment. Also, the regs should be visited by women who are in power,
right,
not just by men.
Hmm. Right. You know, I have to defer entirely to Mickey on this because she makes such excellent points and she has the experience. The only thing I would say is, like, looking at the flyers, at, you know, the website, it looks like it was designed with absolutely zero African-American female input. And, it stigmatizes whole types of hairstyles where, you know, they could fit within a helmet, okay, depending on. It just looks like somebody designed these regs with no thought to how they would sound.
Well, we got to leave it there for now. Interesting discussion. Again, I just want to make the point. Hair is not always just hair. Hair is not just
hair.
So that was Joan Walsh. She's editor-at-large of Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst. Mickey Kendall was also with us. She's a writer and media critic with HoodFeminism.com. Veronica Miller writes about fashion and pop culture for Exo Jane and The Griot. Kelly Goff is a columnist for TheRoot.com and The Daily Beast. Veronica was with us from WHYY in Philadelphia. Mickey was with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Kelly and Joan were both with us from our bureau in New York, leaving me all by myself in Washington, D.C.
Oh, sad.
Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Bye, Michelle.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been